You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up, Hmong agricultural expertise is helping a Wisconsin professor develop the first ever commercial rice crop here in Wisconsin.
First, a federal judge issued an injunction today that requires Wisconsin to cut back on harsh disciplinary practices in youth prisons. The same judge decided last month that the use of solitary confinement and pepper spray at Lincoln Hill School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls is unconstitutional.
The youth prisons are located north of Wausau and have been under FBI investigation for the last couple years for abuse and child neglect. This year, the troubled facilities became the center of a lawsuit filed against the state by the ACLU of Wisconsin and the Juvenile Law Center.
Marsha Levick is deputy director and chief counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, one of the groups that filed the lawsuit on behalf of youth inmates. Marsha, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
So what was your reaction to this judge's decision to issue an injunction today?
Our reaction was very positive. This is an order that was, much of it was agreed upon with the defendants. It was an effort to really put in writing the findings of unconstitutionality that Judge Peterson essentially issued from the bench 2 weeks ago. And it sets really quite substantial limits and I think lays the platform for additional improvements at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lakes, particularly with respect to the use of solitary confinement, mechanical restraints, and pepper spray.
Now, the Department of Corrections had issued a report on changes coming up. I think that was Friday that came out. And again, that was in response to the judge's order. What were some of the key changes that they had put out there?
Well, I think it wasn't so much that they put out changes. What they did was we filed a joint order on Friday afternoon that reflected our effort to set an initial array of parameters to the conditions at Lincoln Hills that were found to be unconstitutional. So the limitations that are set forth in the judge's order require really stark reductions in the use of solitary confinement, in particular with respect to the circumstances under which children can be placed in solitary in terms of limiting it to instances where there is really physical harm involved or physical violence, working mostly to eliminate it with respect to things that are really just rule violations within the facility, curbing substantially the use of pepper spray, which has been an extremely abusive and, of course, harmful practice at these two facilities, drastically limiting the use of mechanical restraints, which have really been almost the default position for children in solitary confinement at these facilities. So as I said, this is really laying the groundwork for what we hope will be a final order, of course, of relief in these cases, but setting forth very substantial limitations and also requiring that these changes be put in place pretty quickly.
That's been a concern, that if there are major changes, it would take time to train personnel at the youth incarceration facilities. What kind of timeline are we looking at for these changes?
Well, a number of the changes have to go into effect almost immediately, July 21st. There are other deadlines set at August 15th, and then there are a couple that reach out to September 30th. I think that we recognize that the judge was trying to balance the very significant harms that the children are experiencing there every day in these facilities with the realization that there's a culture in these two facilities and staff who work there that have not seen themselves in a rehabilitative and treatment relationship vis-a-vis the children there. And I think the judge is trying to allow for the opportunity for the appropriate kinds of training, supports, and resources to be established at these two facilities. But at the same time, by setting some very tight timelines over the next couple of weeks and within the next month, ensuring that some of the most egregious harms immediately be put to rest.
I'm talking to Marsha Levick from the Juvenile Law Center about changes in the works for the state's controversial juvenile corrections facilities, Lincoln Hills School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls. Let's look a little bit at some of the conditions that led to this lawsuit and these changes, Marsha. Starting with solitary confinement, how was solitary confinement used?
Excessively. Just, you know, almost 20% of the population in these two facilities on any given day was in solitary confinement. Youth were locked in their cells often 23, sometimes 24 hours a day, denied access to programming, denied any real opportunity to have educational programming provided to them, lacked mental health treatment, often had progress that they may have been making in treatment programs in the facility essentially halted and placed in a position of having to start over because of the solitary. So with respect to those kinds of conditions, this order requires that there be no breaks in that kind of treatment and therapy that is provided in these facilities, limitations on the number of days, a significant increase in the opportunities that youth who will still be placed in solitary have with respect to opportunities for social interaction, for educational programming, for physical exercise, for to ensure that they meet with mental health counselors in the facility every day. So it's quite a different, much more humane, far less punitive, far less barbaric, frankly, atmosphere that we are trying to create there.
There is still, though, the possibility of solitary confinement, even under these new orders. Is that appropriate, do you think?
We think not, and certainly our goal in the litigation is to seek an end to solitary. We think it is a very inhumane way to treat children, but this is, as it is described, it's a preliminary injunction. It is the first step in this litigation to begin to put very substantial curbs on the treatment there, and recognizing that this is a facility, unfortunately, in your lead, there was certainly acknowledgement of the many years that these facilities have been under investigation for a variety of abusive practices toward children. There needs to be a culture change there. There needs to be training and significantly greater support and resources put into that facility. And this is a first step. It's a very big step, but of course we recognize this is a first step.
Now, this has been a really dramatic situation. You had one State Department, the Department of Justice, in effect raiding another department's facility, the Department of Corrections, an FBI investigation. Has there been any kind of culture change in the years that this has been going on?
Well, I think that's a great question. And frankly, today, it's hard to say. I think that the facility administrators themselves certainly claim that they are working with outside experts to assist them in rethinking how they are running these correction facilities. They are endeavoring to put new training and new kinds of supports in place. I think the children who are there every day are suffering, and they continue to suffer under the conditions in which they are being held. So there may be some changes going on, but I'm not sure they're being felt at the level of the children, and that's what we're concerned about.
Are we seeing more transparency? One issue was that a resident there, an inmate, might be injured and their parents not find out about it, that kind of thing. Are we at least understanding more what's going on there?
I think we have a lot of insight into what's going on there, and of course it's all quite disturbing. We certainly hope through this order itself, as well as the continuing steps in the litigation, to gain a great deal more transparency, to obviously gain much more kind of in-time reporting about what is happening to children there, how the facility is changing its practices and altering the conditions. You know, the goal here is to create a rehabilitative, treatment-centered environment that can help kids and enable them to return to their communities. As these changes become institutionalized within these facilities, that kind of concern about the transparency hopefully will be disclosing what has become a very humane facility rather than one that right now looks anything but that.
And briefly on staffing, there were complaints from employees about low morale, overwork, not enough people. Have we seen staffing changes that might help solve some of these problems?
I think not sufficient, and I think that's certainly one of the considerations that we see reflected in the judge's order. The judge has given the facility about 10 weeks to the end of September to develop both training programs, put training programs in place, to develop new staffing patterns, which was one of the concerns that the defendants raised to ensure that they can provide the kinds of services and opportunities that need to be provided. So, you know, I think we're still in a wait-and-see mode. I think the judge's ruling 2 weeks ago was just an enormous step forward and an important statement about the unconstitutionality of the conditions there. This order today is the next step in a process that we hope will lead to really a transformation that has been long in coming to these two facilities.
Marcia, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Marcia Levick with the Juvenile Law Center. She joined us with thoughts on some of the proposed changes to disciplinary practices at the Lincoln Hills Youth Corrections Facility. You can tune into the Joy Cardin Show tomorrow morning after 7 when Joy is joined by State Senator Lena Taylor of Milwaukee and a representative from the ACLU. Wild rice has been harvested by generations of Native Americans in Wisconsin. And now a Marquette University professor is tapping into the traditional knowledge of another group of Wisconsinites in an effort to begin growing the common white or brown rice that's a staple grain for many people.
Michael Schlappi is an associate professor of biology at Marquette University and is researching how to successfully grow rice on a commercial level here in Wisconsin. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
What are the necessary conditions for growing rice successfully?
Well, the rice I'm growing here, the type of rice really requires flooding. So you have to have a paddy that can be flooded, and the rice needs to be flooded throughout the growing season from tiny seedling to, you know, harvest. So that's one of the main things. And rice doesn't like cold temperature either in general, and that's one of my research topics in my lab too. Investigate differences between cold tolerance and chilling tolerances of rice. So so this is one of the challenges, or, you know, drought would be a challenge, and cold would be a challenge for rice.
And we normally do have cold temperatures in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So how do you get around that?
Well, that's part of my research, and I kind of had this vision, you know, many years ago when I came here that rice, Asian rice, could be grown here because I've seen it being done in northern Japan. So I figured this is a place with lots of water, so abundance of water, and but nobody's growing rice. It's all soybean, corn, maybe wheat, stuff like that. And it happened, so my kind of vision, quote-unquote, happened around the time when there was a lot of drought in California. And I figured, well, since maybe there is going to be a lack of land or a lack of paddies in California, we could maybe replace this in the Midwest. So it comes, you know, it's this research kind of that I'm doing to understand cold tolerance. This has to do more with growing seasons or growing regions in Arkansas, which grows the most rice. But they would like to grow rice earlier because they have, like, inclement weather in the fall. But then it came also to the stage, well, why not here in Wisconsin? Why not in a place where we have ample resources of water? Also, there's a lot of boggy land that people cannot use, farmers cannot use for wheat and soybean or corn. This could be used for rice. So this all, you know, was the idea of doing this here.
And you've just put a rice paddy in the Mequon Nature Preserve. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the rice paddies, again, so to establish something requires, you know, not just ideas, but also manpower, engineers, funding. Funding is a big thing, right? For many years, I just experimented on rooftop paddies. I made little, you know, four raised bed paddies at the rooftop of Marquette University to figure out which varieties of rice could be grown in Wisconsin. So that was the first step. But through contact, through connection with the Fondy Food Center, the Fondy Food Center now has access to land at the Mequon Nature Preserve. And because I was already part of the Fondy for a couple of years, then now we had the opportunity to grow, to build paddies near some ponds from which we can then pump water into the paddies. So with funding and engineering and, you know, access to water, we were able to do this at the Nature Preserve. But it's through the connections, the community connections, with the Fondy Food Center. Also there then come in the Hmong farmers, because I think 80% of the farmers who lease, land from the Fawnee Food Center are of Hmong origin.
Yeah, and so you're tapping into the knowledge and the expertise of some of these local Hmong residents. What prompted you to connect with that community?
Yes, yeah, so now you get it. The Hmong, the farmers, current farmers, many of them used to be, you know, in refugee camps in Thailand or places like this. And when they came to the States, farming is kind of in their DNA, if you will. They're absolutely fantastic farmers, but they thought, you know, you can't grow rice in a cold climate such as Wisconsin. But now I'm trying to convince them this is possible, and they still have the knowledge of what it needs to build a paddy, what it needs to plant rice. They've done it by hand. You know, 2 weeks ago we've done this. We had several sections of paddies, and one section was planted by Hmong farmers by hand. But ultimately, this is not going to be sustainable. But they at least they know, they have done this before. They have all the knowledge, and the connection is simply through being, you know, farmers. We're both farmers. I'm trying to become a farmer, I guess. But I met them as part of the Fondia Food Center connection.
Have they taught you things about rice that you learned from them by watching them?
I think one of the first things we've learned this year, because this is the first time we try to grow rice for production, so we want to try to sell it this year, or have enough rice, at least at an experimental level, so we can sell it in farmers markets, you know, maybe at the local outpost store in Mequon. Because it's the first large-scale production attempt, we thought, well, leveled paddy is enough. But what they pointed out, what I learned from the Hmong farmers, is it has to be perfect. It has to be perfectly leveled. Mm-hmm. And two farmers who just came here from Laos 2 years ago mentioned through a translator that they spend a lot of time leveling the paddies before they plant, and that's what we have to do next year. So that's the main lesson I've already learned from them.
We're talking right now with Michael Schlappi. He's an associate professor of biology at Marquette University, and he's looking into how hardy domesticated rice varieties could be grown and harvested here in Wisconsin. Michael, you have just put in this patch of rice paddies, if you will, over at the Mequon Nature Preserve.
Correct.
Does this fit into what the mission of that nature preserve is about?
Well, the mission, I think, is I'm a little bit rusty with all the details, but it's part of a land trust, Wisconsin Land Trust, to reestablish the area into what it used to be. And what used to be there were wetlands in this area of the nature preserve. But it's also legit to grow, perform agriculture, to grow stuff on parts that are zoned for that. And so there is a homestead farm that's part of the nature preserve, which I think is about 80 acres or so that can be used for agriculture. But what I think my mission is fitting in part of this restoration of the wetlands. We're making kind of artificial wetlands, but it's still attracting a lot of the wildlife that you would expect to be in a wetland, insects, amphibians, birds. And I think that's, I find that really nice that we can contribute to this, to the mission of restoring the area to its almost natural state. Even though we can consider it artificial, nevertheless, it will be a wetland.
What comes next in your research then?
If we're successful, and I hope we will be, in selling this locally grown rice to at farmers markets, maybe give it or sell it to restaurants and organic stores such as Outpost Natural Food. If we're successful doing this, we can reinvest this money into more research to find the best variety that can grow the best, that is maybe even a bit drought tolerant if we need that. So this is part of the research. I want to tie in my research in abiotic stress tolerance of rice with then developing an excellent variety that can grow locally and has the highest yield and is disease resistant and, you know, stress resistant, stuff like that.
And when are you eyeing for harvest? What is your point of harvest?
It should be around mid to late September. This year might be a bit later because we had a late start with a very chilly spring. And even though those plants can survive chilling temperatures, even cold temperatures, they're still sat there. You know, they were not developing too well. So this year it might be pushed into October. But I think what we want to achieve, so we want to grow rice or have a rice variety that flowers, makes seeds in early August, and then we can harvest it about mid-September.
Do you think that there's a market? Will people want to buy this rice grown in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's a good question. So this part of this innovation grant I received from Marquette University to fund this whole project, part of it is to involve students from the business school, from communications, you know, from advertisement and areas like that. So those undergrad students that work with me as interns, they're doing a little bit of market research, and they're trying to figure out whether there is the market. But I can tell you anecdotally already that I've been approached by local chefs who are really interested in using locally sourced food, and rice is one of the foods that you can't get locally in Wisconsin. So our project would be the first time that ever, you know, that Asian rice was grown at the scale that can be then, you know, pitched to places, to organizations like organizations, but restaurants and food stores. So yeah, there is, in anecdotally at least, there is quite a bit of interest. Also, I think people are more willing to pay more money for something that's organic and locally grown, instead of, you know, the carbon footprint would be very, very reduced the way we do this here.
Well, Michael, we'll look forward to updates on your work. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. No, thanks for having me.
Michael Schlappi is an associate professor of biology at Marquette University. He joined us there to talk about research on growing rice in Wisconsin that has tapped into the expertise of local Hmong residents.
Now, news broke over the weekend that President Donald Trump's oldest son, Donald Trump Jr., had met with a Russian lawyer during the 2016 campaign after she promised him damaging information about Hillary Clinton's campaign. The meeting included Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
Chris Edelson joins us. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Government at American University. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, the headlines in the press calling this meeting a bombshell, but the president's chief of staff calling it a big nothing burger. How big of a deal is this news of this meeting with the Russian lawyer?
It's huge. Nothing like this has happened in American history. And in the context of what we already know, it's even bigger. I'm personally reeling from what's happened over the weekend.
Break it down for us. What is so incredible about this news?
So we've been hearing a lot about whether there was collusion between Russia and Trump campaign. And we know there have been contacts. We know that there were lies about the contacts. Initially, everyone in the Trump campaign said no one met with the Russians. Sessions testified about that. It wasn't true. They have. So now the question is, were they helping? Were they working with them? And this meeting is the first clear evidence that they were doing that. This meeting took place in June of 2016. Trump Jr. was there. Kushner was there. Manafort was there. Trump Jr. says by his own words, he says he was there because he was told somebody turned out to be a Russian lawyer who's close to the government in Russia, was going to give damaging information about Hillary Clinton. That's working with the Russians. That's what he was there for. Now, he says he made a very weird, he's changed his story a couple times, but he admits that's what he was there for. The question is, did he get it? What exactly happened? What really happened? What did the other people know about it? But by his own words, he says he was there to get information from a foreign power that's hostile to the United States.
So tell us a little bit more about this meeting. It was presumed that this was going to be a time where there would be some opposition research on Hillary Clinton, but the meeting pivoted very quickly, I understand from these accounts, to adoption.
It's impossible to know exactly what happened because there have been multiple stories. I wouldn't use the term opposition research. It's too sanitized. Opposition research is something that's legitimate. This was information that he was going to get from a hostile foreign power. Initially, when the story broke, what Trump Jr. said was, oh, well, we spoke about adoption. Okay, that sounds innocent. It's actually not in the larger context, because that's something that Russia did when it retaliated against sanctions that were imposed by the United States in the Magnitsky Act. But then he changed the story, and he said, no, I wasn't there to talk about adoption. I was there because this person, who turned out to be a Russian lawyer tied to the government, was going to give me information that was damaging to the Hillary Clinton campaign. That's not opposition research. That's information from a hostile foreign power. Like I say, there have been different versions of the story. We don't know exactly what happened, but that's what he says happened. His version now, his latest version is, I went there to get this information. She told me something about Hillary Clinton, but it was vague and confusing. And then we talked about the Magnitsky Act, which was a law that the United States passed to punish Russia for human rights violations that Putin does not like. Putin retaliated by prohibiting Americans from adopting Russian children. That's what's meant by the adoption part of the story. So that raises the question of a quid pro quo. Was the Russian lawyer saying to Trump and Kushner and Manafort, hey, if you drop the Magnitsky Act, we'll lift this ban on adoption? We don't know, but that's a question I would certainly want to find out more about.
What do we know about this Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya? What is her background in the Kremlin, too, with ties to the Kremlin?
Very connected lawyer, well-connected, represented businesses that are tied to the Kremlin. I think somebody, a child of a high-ranking official, if I remember correctly, she's certainly somebody who is an insider, and that's what we know. Was she there at Putin's request? Was she there because someone else in the government told her to be? I don't know, but those are certainly questions that need to be asked.
So how do ethics experts say that Donald Trump Jr. should have reacted in this meeting when it went a different direction?
I mean, I think he should have reacted differently from the beginning. What people have been saying, so his position is, hey, what's the big deal? Everyone, if anyone was told they would get information about their opponent, of course they'd go to hear it out. What Republicans are saying, Stuart Stevens, who was Romney's campaign advisor, John Weaver, who was advisor Republican campaigns, is no. When a hostile foreign power tells you, and by the way, he didn't know who he was going to be meeting with, apparently. He was told you're going to meet with an unidentified person from Russia who will give you information. What these Republican operatives said is, you go to the FBI when that happens. That's dangerous stuff. So Richard Painter, who was the ethics lawyer for George W. Bush, said, you call the FBI. This is really, Russia is a hostile power. Russia has, we know now that they interfered with the 2016 election, but even before that, they're an authoritarian country run by a dictator, hostile to U.S. interests. Nobody, Republicans, understand this. This is not a friendly country. They're not an ally. They're an adversary. We're not at war with them in a shooting sense, but even before 2016, they were not a friendly country. So I think any country getting in touch with you in the context of a presidential campaign would raise really important questions about possible crimes. The fact that it was Russia, that's, you know, I think the response people have consistently given who are involved in politics, Republicans involved in politics, is you don't go to the meeting, you call the FBI.
And we're talking right now with Chris Edelson from American University about this news over the weekend that Donald Trump Jr. met with a Russian lawyer during the 2016 election. And after he was promised this apparently disparaging information about Hillary Clinton. Now, as we look back in history, are there any comparable examples of similar meetings with foreign governments?
No, not really. I mean, that's part of what's so really hard to kind of grasp about this. Donald Trump Jr. is saying, oh, no big deal. People do this all the time. No, they don't. Nobody does this. It's never happened. The only example I can think of that's roughly comparable, and it's not a good example for the Trumps, is in 1968, Lyndon Johnson found out that the Nixon administration was secretly communicating with North Korea, North Vietnam during the Vietnam War to undermine the peace talks. Lyndon Johnson believed that was treason. I don't think what happened here meets the definition of treason. Again, we're not at war with Russia. It certainly raises questions about criminal activity, though, and it's just mind-boggling. I don't really have words for this. It is unprecedented. The only comparison, as I say, is the 1968 one. That one's not exact, but that's not a good comparison.
And according to Donald Trump Jr., the now President Trump knew nothing about this meeting. How might this meeting reflect back on the president, even though he wasn't personally there?
Well, we don't know, of course. So I'm a lawyer by background. When people say things that are conflicting, when they give different accounts, which Donald Trump Jr. has done, which Jared Kushner has done, which Michael Flynn has done, various people in the Trump administration have done, they lose their credibility. Donald Trump himself has done this. We don't know exactly what Donald Trump knew and didn't know. That's something we have to find out. So if I were an investigator involved in this case, either in Congress or in the Mueller team, I'd want to speak to the people who were there. You start with them. Let's try to get his story straight. What exactly happened? You have different accounts from Donald Trump Jr. There were other people there. Let's see what they said. Do their stories line up? And then let's find out, are they telling the truth? I mean, the obvious question I would have is Donald Trump Jr. trying to protect his father?
And do you see that the special investigation into Russia's role in the 2016 election, do you see the special investigators looking at this meeting? Do we have any evidence of that?
Well, of course, Robert Mueller's investigation is confidential. No one knows for sure what he's looking at. I'm just guessing that those are things he'd want to know about. In Congress, yeah, I saw Congressman Adam Schiff, who's the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, said, you got to talk to the people who were at the meeting. Of course, that makes sense. I also saw that, I just saw this, Donald Trump Jr. has hired a lawyer. Not surprising, because I think the expectation is he will be questioned about this.
We're talking right now to Chris Edelson from American University about the news that Donald Trump Jr. met with a Russian lawyer during the 2016 election after he was promised some disparaging information about Hillary Clinton. Two members of President Trump's campaign staff also attended the meeting.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the news that came out this weekend? How do you think it'll affect the special investigation into potential Russian interference in the 2016 election? How does this reflect on President Trump and his campaign? Do you think there should be any action taken because of this news? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation and get to your calls in just a minute here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're picking up our discussion now about a meeting during the 2016 election between Donald Trump Jr., Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort, President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner, and a Kremlin-tied lawyer who promised damaging information about Hillary Clinton.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this news? What questions do you have? Is this a big deal in your mind or not? What would you like to see happen next when it comes to the special investigation, to how Congress reacts? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go right to the phones now with Kyle in Milwaukee. Hi, Kyle. Go ahead.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Chris, I was just curious on, given the previous support that Trump has been given by his supporters, how do you think they should be reacting to something like this, and how do you think they will react?
Good questions. I think this is not a partisan issue. We should react as Americans. We should be defending our country, Russia, and this should be understood. This isn't the only story that came out over the weekend. We also saw Donald Trump meeting with Vladimir Putin, an authoritarian dictator, in Hamburg, and Donald Trump preposterously proposed setting up a joint cybersecurity project with Russia, which we know hacked and interfered with our election. So as Americans, I hope we'll stand up for our country. It's not a partisan issue. This has nothing to do with what you think about health care or taxes or anything like this. This has to do with where you stand on the United States and constitutional democracy versus Russian authoritarianism. I don't know about Trump supporters. I know there are plenty of Republicans who understand this. David Frum, Evan McMullen, Anna Navarro, John Weaver, plenty of them who they understand this is not partisan. This is about the country. And I hope people will see that. And I know many do.
Kyle, thanks so much for your call. Let's take a moment here and talk about this cybersecurity unit.
Yeah.
President Trump tweeted yesterday morning that he and Putin had discussed forming this so-called unit. But then last night, the president tweeted again saying that just because he and Putin discussed this, it doesn't mean he thinks it can happen. Why the two different tweets?
Again, we were talking about credibility. The Trump administration, I'm sorry to say, the president himself, they're all over the place. You can never pin them down from one story to the next. And in fact, there's even been more news since then. I saw that Congressman Ted Lieu from California and Ruben Gallego from Arizona, I believe, are proposing legislation to block this, which suggests that they either think it's happening or it is happening, that the administration is proposing this. It's bizarre. I mean, people have made all kinds of comparisons. They said this is like after Pearl Harbor going to Japan and saying, let's set up a joint project to prevent attacks against the United States. I mean, this was not a, fortunately, people weren't killed in the Russian attack, but this was people, a former head of the CIA, Michael Morell, said this was the political equivalent of 9/11. So to suggest, even whether to propose it or suggest it or even just think about it, to work with the Russians, who we know have interfered with our election and tried to undermine our constitutional democracy, to suggest we would work with them is really, I was physically affected for 24 hours at least after that. I mean, my body didn't feel right. It's really upsetting and disturbing stuff. And again, many people understand this. Lindsey Graham, a Republican senator from South Carolina, said it's maybe not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close.
Let's take another.
U.S. said something similar, and Ben Sasse as well. So there are people who understand this.
Let's go to Jim now in Eau Claire. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think Russia is a hostile foreign power. We have detente with them, and they vote with us often on the U.N. Security Council. I mean, they've done some things against us, but we don't really know that much that this woman, a lawyer, actually has proven ties with the Kremlin. It's a lot of assumptions there.
She does have ties with the Kremlin. She's represented businesses that are owned by the state. She represented someone who's a child of a government official. We do know that Russia is a hostile power. John McCain, who's a Republican senator from Arizona, said Vladimir Putin is a thug, a murderer, and a bully. Anyone who tells you differently is lying. Russia is an authoritarian regime. There's a divide in the world right now between democracies and authoritarianism. Putin's on the wrong side. The idea that the United States could be allied with Russia is really a dangerous one.
Critics are pointing out that the Trump family stories about Russia seem to be changing quite a bit. What do you think about that criticism, and what about these changing positions on Russia?
Well, as I said, it raises credibility concerns. I don't know when Donald Trump Jr. says one thing one day and one thing the next day. He's actually said three different things. In March, he said, I never met with anyone from Russia in the context of the campaign. Then he said, yeah, I did, but we just talked about adoption. And then he said, no, actually, I was there because I thought I'd get damning information about Hillary Clinton. It's impossible to know what to believe, but there are credibility problems across the administration, whether it's Trump Jr. He's not in the administration, but he obviously was involved in the campaign and close to his father, Donald Trump himself, Jared Kushner, Michael Flynn, who left the administration. It's Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, who testified before the Senate, his confirmation hearing, said he didn't meet with Russians, but later had to amend that. This is very sad to me. As an American, it's impossible to know what's right.
Chris, what are you watching for as the story continues to unfold?
I'd say two things mainly. One, which is hard to watch because it's mainly behind closed doors, what is the Mueller investigation going to do? Robert Mueller, the former FBI director under George W. Bush, who's investigating possible criminal activity associated with the Trump campaign and the Trump administration, what will they do? It's hard to know. We can't really know until he's done, probably. The second question is, will Republicans in Congress take action? I mentioned some who are clearly disturbed about this. They're saying things that are suggesting they're concerned. Are they going to take any actions based on that?
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
That was Chris Edelson. He's assistant professor in the Department of Government at American University. He joined us to talk about news that Donald Trump Jr. met with a Russian lawyer in 2016 after she promised damaging information about Hillary Clinton.
In the last decade, the number of Wisconsin newborns needing treatment for opioid withdrawal has quadrupled to nearly 600 a year. In the first of a series of stories, Kyla Calvert-Mason reports on a clinic in La Crosse that's asking how to better treat the mothers during pregnancy.
Dr. Charles Schauberger happened into an unexpected end-of-career specialty when he took over a high-risk obstetrics clinic at Gunderson Health Systems more than 5 years ago. The patients included a few expectant mothers addicted to opioids.
You're in drug screen? Nope, not this patient.
He now treats 20 to 25 at any given time and has had more than 170 addiction patients. The need for clinics like his is likely even greater than state data show. Schauberger says many addicted mothers try to deliver at hospitals where they're not known.
Or they think that they can keep their secret as to the fact that they're using opioids, and they probably get out of the hospital before the baby develops some symptoms.
Most of his patients with substance abuse disorder get pregnant while taking medications like methadone or buprenorphine to treat their addictions.
About a third of them are people who've been using who accidentally got pregnant, and not only are they learning about pregnancy care and getting used to being pregnant, but they're also very new to treatment for drug use.
Some are referred from treatment programs. Others come by word of mouth, a testament to the trust the clinic staff builds with patients who are often leery of doctors and other service providers. Jean Colburn is the clinic's primary coordinating nurse.
I try to help them to understand that I am not judging them. This is a disease. If they were being treated for diabetes, if they were being treated for cancer, if they were being treated for any other medical condition, we would do whatever we can.
Mothers have more frequent appointments and ultrasounds during pregnancy. Colburn and the clinic's dedicated social worker also help fill other needs. They can connect patients with transportation and housing or help them sign up for food and medical assistance. Schauberger says it takes a delicate balance to get patients to believe their goal is to keep moms and babies together, especially when it comes to regular drug screenings and working with Child Protective Services.
What I tell them is, I want to see you establish a pattern of urine drug screens that are clean so that we can take this to CPS and say, look, she's had 6 urine drug screens over the course of the pregnancy, and they've all been free of any unprescribed drugs.
Holding her hours-old baby boy, Ashley Spears says that's why she's stuck with Schauberger.
I want to keep him. So I was honest about my addiction, and I wanted help, and I just didn't know what kind of help I was going to be able to get.
They were able to help her get into a residential treatment program where she and her son can stay while she continues treatment.
It's the normal questions we ask everybody. Anybody in the family born deaf or hard of hearing?
Nicole Hennessy is checking in on new babies and their moms. She runs the Gunderson Hospital Pediatrics Unit that takes over after delivery, and she wanted the support for moms with addiction to continue through their stay. In the past, all newborns treated for withdrawal went to intensive care. Now, Hennessy says, Gunderson is the only hospital in the state where they stay in mom's room like any other baby.
Moms are allowed to bond more. They're also seeing the signs of withdrawal and are coached by the nurses as to how to calm that withdrawal without needing medicine.
Unit nurses have also been trained on how best to monitor babies at risk for withdrawal and how to build better relationships with the moms. Hennessy says they've shortened average hospital stays for babies suffering from withdrawal from 3 weeks to 10 to 14 days. Spears says without the support, things would be different.
I wouldn't be holding him. He'd be with somebody else. He'd be in foster care.
Her relationship with Gunderson isn't ending. Her son will be a patient in a new pediatrics clinic caring for drug-exposed children. Kyla Calvert-Mason, Wisconsin Public Radio.